All right, testing 1, 2, 3, testing 1, 2, 3. Hi, good morning.
Morning, Rabbi.
Hey, Jim, how you doing?
Very well, how are you today, sir?
Okay, sir. Has your earaches all gone?
They are. I'm doing much better. Thank you.
Good. Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning, Rabbi. God bless everybody. Good week.
Good morning.
Morning, Carol. Morning, Doug.
Morning.
Who's it, Carolyn?
Yeah, Carolyn. Hi, Rabbi.
How you doing?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay. Okay, so I think everybody's on. And how's the sound? Let me just ask before we start. Okay. All right, so we're up to Koheles. We actually just read it on last Shabbos. It's on the various holidays, so the rabbis said that we read various books in Koheles. As we've seen over the past couple of years of doing Koheles, I know we must be doing this over 3 years now. And we see that he's addressing life, the philosophy of life, and then and the various considerations and, you know, different fronts, whether it's friendships or business or money, attitudes. And like Rabbi Chait explained, the three holidays that we have of Passover, Shavuos, and Sukkos are in a sequence, and he said very succinctly but very clear that Passover is leaving the wrong ideas of Egypt. So God removed us from the influences of Egypt, saved us from that idolatrous culture, wherein, according to Rashi, the vast majority of Jews were killed. 4/5 of the Jews, of the Jewish population, were killed in Egypt along with the Egyptians because of their sins. The Jews actually had descended, and as one of the Rishonim write, one of the great rabbis write, that the whole time that the 12 tribes were alive and then the Jews were in Egypt, they lived fine, they were not corrupt, they didn't follow any idolatry. Evidently, the presence of those tribes that came from Jacob and from who came from Isaac and who came from Abraham, so evidently there was still an influence, and they must have been guiding the people to live according to the right code of law, the Noahide laws that they had, because that's all they had at that point. So they lived properly, and God was with them, and they were doing well. They lived in the best part of Egypt, in Goshen. But soon after the 12 tribes had had died and passed on. So the Jews had succumbed to idolatry. And that was the reason why they were enslaved. There was a punishment. It wasn't, God doesn't afflict somebody who didn't do anything wrong. So God eventually took us out. He created, Maimonides says, God created Moses. It sounds like he's saying that he created such a high level intellect, but also at the right place at the right time. And as Rabbi Chaya explained, it was only through Moses that the miracles could be done. Evidently, there had to be a great understanding of what God was doing, and then Moses would be able to interpret, like for example, with the plague of hail. So after the plague had commenced, it was terrifying to the Egyptians. Again, Rabbi Chaya explained, because they were very afraid of the skies, of the heavens, and these giant stones coming down and mixed with flames and the sound of thunder, it also says there, is very terrifying. And Moses, but Moses told an additional thing to Pharaoh. It wasn't merely a plague. Moses understood, and he said to Pharaoh, if you notice, the stiff plants are breaking. I think the wheat, the barley, well, the wheat and the spelt, that those the stiff plants are breaking, but the ones that ripen later, so they're still soft because they aren't firm yet, so the softer ones are bending before the hail. So the hail is only breaking the stiff ones. So it sounds like Moses is telling this to Pharaoh for a reason, not just to give him some sort of agricultural accounting, but he's trying to show that God understands that one of the major problems with Pharaoh's personality was that he was obstinate. And something which is stiff will break. So that was Moses' message to Pharaoh, was that this plague is not arbitrary. It's actually a parallel. It's a metaphor for a flaw that you have, Pharaoh. But this was only seen through Moses. And once we see it, then we can readily appreciate Moses' insight into the plague. And this was not something which God told Moses to say. And there were other cases too, where you have the case where the boils, what was the reason for the boils? And the verses say that the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses because the boils were on the astrologers and on all of Egypt. So the problem that you have there is that, why do we care that the boils are on the Egyptians too? The whole point is to say that the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses. So what we should care about is because the boils were on the astrologers. What's the relevance of the fact that the boils were also on other people, on all of the Egyptian people? How would that affect the posture or the ability to appear before Moses, just if we're just concerned about the astrologers in that verse? But you see that one additional statement, that the boils were also on all of Egypt, gives us insight. And the problem was that boils are really not an issue about, it's not a muscular disease or an ailment or something in the joints or the bones. It's on the surface. It's on the skin. It's only skin deep. So that would not affect a person to stand. But there's another idea that you can explain. What does it mean that the astrologers couldn't stand before Moses? It means they couldn't appear. They had no dignity anymore. They were feigning a certain power. And they made all these claims. And they, of course, would be careful not to make claims that they couldn't really substantiate. They would say, you know, well, it'll still happen soon. When they interpreted Pharaoh's dreams about the seven cows and the seven ears, they said, this means you're going to have seven daughters, you're going to bury seven daughters. So if Pharaoh says, you know, hey, it didn't happen yet, are you guys really telling me the truth? So the astrologers can defend themselves and say, it'll still happen in the future. It's not supposed to happen yet, so they can protect themselves. But here they were completely stripped away because they had boils on the body and they could not remove the boils. And it showed them to be equal to the rest of the Egyptians. That's why it says that the boils were on the astrologers and the Egyptians. It's a statement of equation, that God is equating the Egyptians to these astrologers. Nobody's different. The astrologers are not any more capable They have no more power than a common Egyptian. That's why it says they couldn't appear before Moses, because they couldn't uphold their face anymore with claims of importance, any special qualities or powers. Because if they could remove the boils from their own bodies, what type of astrologers are they? What type of magicians are they? So that's why it's important that the verse tells us that crucial statement, the boils were on the astrologers and the rest of the population, to make an equation. They're no different. That's why they couldn't stand before Moses. So after all this, and after all, and again, you go through the plagues, there's a tremendous amount. There's so many levels of insight, and just why they came and why in that order. But you see that God had created Moses, and he took out the Jews. So that was the extrication from a very corrupt culture. So that was the first holiday, is to remove the Jews from the wrong culture. And Shavuos is the next holiday, which clearly is to receive the right ideas. That's receiving the Torah on Sinai. So that's the second step in the development. And the third is Sukkos, which we just celebrated, but as Rabbi Shea explained, which is the final step, and that is to live the correct philosophy. So you have to leave the wrong ideas, you have to attach yourself to the right ideas, and you have to live those ideas. And that's not just for those Jews back then, that's for every person that walks the face of the earth, is to make this type of a progress in their life. So Sukkos is living that right life, because what you're doing is you're abandoning the security. The greatest security a person has is his home. And we'll touch on that a bit with the words of Kehelis today. And so therefore, God wants a person to demonstrate that he really relies on God. And that's the real security. So he leaves his house and he goes into a frail structure. The walls can be made of metal, but if your ceiling is made of plant life, so then that really is what determines that your exposure to the elements. And you trust in God. So you remove yourself from the security of your own work of your hands, and demonstrate that you're really living in accordance with God wants, and you depend on God. So that's really the culmination of the three holidays. But then we show that we are thankful for everything that he gives us, that he really supports us. He supports our lives. That's why it comes together. Samson and Raphael Hirsch explain that's why you also have the waving of the four species of plants and fruits on this holiday. It comes together with Sukkos. Because the Sukkos is a breakdown of your own security, of your own false security, and then it's a redirection of your dependency upon God for your life, and that's what waving these fruits in all the directions. We wave the fruits up and down, the Talmud says, and then we also wave it in all four directions, north, south, east, and west. So the question is, why are we waving these fruits in these two different units, up and down, in a vertical fashion, and then also in a horizontal fashion? So it's not merely geometry over here. It's because up and down demonstrates that this dependence that we have on God, by taking these fruits, which really represents sustaining our lives. So waving the fruits up and down means to say, what is up and what is down? Up and down refers, well, let me ask you, let's make this a question, see if you could see a difference. So what's the difference? What does up and down refer to? And what does north, south, east, and west refer to? What's the difference between those two types of wavings? Or those two directions? Let me put it that way. Well, either one by themselves is only two-dimensional. Up and down is two-dimensional, and forward, back, left, and right is also. It's on one axis. So it's either, if you want to use up and down being the x-axis and the forward, back, left, and right, the y-axis, each one by itself is still only one plane. When you have them together, so then you have two, but what would be each one individually be referencing that the other one doesn't reference?
Well, north, south, east, and west represents the entire plane on which a person can walk.
Okay, good. Man's actions. Man's activities. And what's up and down?
Would that be like heaven and hell in a sense?
Heaven and hell? Well, I don't think anybody witnessed hell. It would have to be something that's within our experience. It has to be something which is within human experience.
I know I've sat through a couple of movies that got closed.
What's that?
I've sat through a couple of bad movies that got closed.
Oh, really? We have to exclude special effects in this discussion.
Okay. Now I'm thinking of the quality of the movie.
Oh, okay.
Well, up and down represents, I suppose, you know, the area from where man is out through the entire universe.
Okay, good. I mean, the universe and Earth, up and down, everything that's out there and we're, and everything below, meaning it encompasses all the entire universe, meaning all created. So I agree with you that this is what the two wavings are to represent, meaning when we strip ourselves of our own security by leaving our, you know, very sturdy houses for a whole week, we live, we eat, and we sleep, and we relax, everything should be done in the sukkah. That's the law. And then we redirect our security in God by taking the food that we have, these fruits, and waving them. So we're showing that He is the cause of all creation. That's up and down. Everything that exists. But not only is He the cause of all creation, but He's also the one who governs everything post-creation. And that is in terms of man's direction. Meaning all of man's actions, forward, back, left, and right. So that's to show that God governs the creation, not in the fact that He created everything, but that He guides the universe. It's you could boil it down to created matter and the government of that matter. And that's a theme which we see throughout the Torah. That's why the holidays, the two main prayers are that God's the creator, He's the king, but that also that He remembers, He knows what's going on in the world, and He governs it, and He relates to it. So He's all omnipotent, all-powerful, and omniscient, all-knowing. And I believe also if you look in Genesis that we're reading now, you see the beginning, it talks about the creation of everything. But the Sforno says, I never saw it before, but he said that after everything was created, then the laws were put into place that governs everything that's created, which makes sense because you can't have laws of a harmony. If God creates a law called harmony of the universe, you can't create the law of the harmony of the universe on the second day. There's so much yet that has to be created. So anything that's going to be harmonious will only be whatever was created up to that second day. So if God wants true harmony in the universe, of all the laws, of all the things that He made, He has to wait until the final moment that He created everything, and then subsequent to the completion of creation, does He then establish laws of how these things should work together. So again, it brings up those two ideas again. That He created everything, but then He governs everything, and that requires His knowledge of everything. So since, to answer our original question, Why do we read Kehelis, which is all about life and the right philosophy? Because, like Rabbi Chait said, that's the holiday we're really living, we're putting into action our convictions, we're demonstrating our convictions. We left the wrong ideas in Egypt. We received the right ideas on Sinai. And now we live that by showing a real reliance on God. Of course, we don't rely on miracles. God gave us natural laws to operate within, because He wants us to. He doesn't want us to sit back and deny natural law and think that your belly is going to be full without work. You have to toil. And in the future, He's going to make it easier. And the Sforno says that a number of times on his commentary in Genesis. And that in the future, it will return, the world will return to how it was by the days of Adam. That he didn't have to toil, everything was prepared for him food-wise, there was no need for work until he sinned. But in the future, it will return back to that way. Because man can live that way. There is not an internal need to work. It's a necessary, something necessary. Duties of the heart, he says, why a person has to work. Because otherwise he'll sin, he'll put his energies into other areas. That's one reason. And another thing it does is that it gives expression to his values. Because how does he deal with people? If a person doesn't have to work, he could, for all purposes, just lounge all day. He doesn't have to interact with others. But working, he can't do everything himself. He may be able to be a farmer, but he's not going to be able to also be a shoemaker. There's only so much you can do. So he has to rely on others for all the other needs that he has, for clothing or for building or whatever or for food, whatever the supplies he can't address himself. So that requires interaction with others. And therefore, there will be a need for him to express himself in the proper morality. So therefore, work also, according to the duties of the heart, the author, he says that this is another reason for work. So we read Kehelis, because since Sukkos is about the expression of the right life, it's the ideas of the right life that come together on a holiday where we express living the right life, so therefore it's read. That's why we read Kehelis, I believe, on this holiday. Because it's really the culmination. All right, let me see if there's any questions or comments.
I'm here.
Okay. All right. All right, so let's take the verse we're up to now. So now we're at 10:18. All right, so it says as follows. With slothfulness or laziness, the roof will sag, and with the lowness of the hands, with the lack of work, the house will drip. Like a verse out of left field. Everything seemed to be so sequential up to this point. So atlas means laziness, a person who doesn't do anything. So if he's inactive, so then he doesn't take care of his home. So then the roof is going to sag. Things always break. That's just the way that things are. Everything deteriorates. It gets old. It rusts. So you have to address it. You have to replace stones. You have to replace bricks. But if you don't tend to it, and you just let nature and aging bear and wear down on your home, so then your roof is going to start to sag. And if you don't act, meaning shiftless yadayim, your laziness or weakness of the hands, meaning you don't act, so then your house will start dripping. The rain's going to come in. Okay, my favorite question is, so what are the questions in the verse? Yeah. What's just we understand it seems to be very straightforward. So what's it doing?
Plant seeds, crops won't grow. Solomon must have been saying something further because the simple meaning of the words is so clear and so obvious that I would presume.
Exactly.
I suppose our second question is, why did he use the house as the metaphor?
Good, good question. What else can we ask or comment on? Good. Another subject in the sentence is roof. What else? Let's call it laziness and the weakness of the hands, or the failure to address. What else? There's something else in the verse too. And so far we're addressing, number one, the context, what's it doing here, and number two, the various subjects or the topics. But what about the structure of the verse? What can we say about the structure?
It seems to me that it's kind of going from the top down, like the ceiling first, and then it talks about the house.
All right. Can't hear you, Jim. Louder, please.
Yes. Can we see this as stages, that first the rafter sinks and then the house leaks?
Yes, stages. Meaning it's doubled. The verse is doubled. That's what I was trying to get you to say. There's two parts. We saw it, but it's just good to identify that, so it just brings it into, you know, clear focus. He's saying, like you're saying, two stages. So let's talk about that. What's the stages?
Well, wait a second. When you say stage, that implies one comes first and the other comes second.
Yes.
How did we establish that?
Okay, good question. I think you can prove it. There's one word that you can use to prove it.
What's that?
There's one word, I believe, which would prove Jim's point that it's a stage. It's a subsequent. This is the first part is dealing prior in time to the second part of the verse.
Well, the second part of the verse doesn't necessarily relate to the roof.
It says that it'll drip. You'll start having rain coming in.
Right. It leaks from all kinds of places that aren't the roof.
I would say that it's talking about one matter here, that at first, if the idleness of the hands, meaning the laziness, the roof is going to sag. After it sags, then it leaks. Because why else is it sagging? Except for the fact that the water is not being, it's starting to wear its way in. Something is causing weight, then ultimately it starts to drip in.
Okay.
And we could also ask about, you asked earlier, what's the difference between the laziness or the weakness of the hands, right? I think those are the main questions. It's interesting, you know, it is a small verse, but as you start going into it, digging into it, you start seeing, There's a number of things over here. Again, why the house? Why is that primarily the issue that he brings up? So now we have the questions. Now we can try to suggest answers now. So take a moment to...
I can guess on the house because a house is a false sense of security.
Okay, and why does he want to bring that in here? Why does he want to bring that
in? Sometimes we feel like when we've got this house, we can just kind of sit in it and be, all of our needs are taken care of, and they're not if we don't maintain them, and it's kind of a metaphor for our lives in the sense of maintaining our relationship with Hashem.
Right, I would agree. I would even say further that the house is the most primary expression of security, which is exactly what we just said about leaving the house and going into the sukkah. That's why that's the law. Precisely that's what God's intent is. It's to break down the most primary area of security. You see, security is something which the Torah carries through. That's why there's a mezuzah, is a Torah law. You have to put a mezuzah on your doorpost. You have to have tefillin on your body, and you have to have tzitzis on your clothing, because there's three areas that a person invests in his security. The house is primarily, but also his clothing, how he dignifies himself, and he gets a certain security about his presentation to others. But his body, certainly, a person is, I think, most acutely aware of how he looks at his body, and that gives him some senses of security, a very strong sense. That's me. That's the closest thing to me. Interesting is that the punishment for a person when he speaks evil speech about other people is leprosy. And the leprosy first attacks the house. If he doesn't heed the warning, it then moves to his clothing. And if he still ignores it, then it ultimately attaches to his body. The same three areas. So you see that this idea of the house being an area of security is throughout the Torah. And I'd even go another step. Now to answer what we originally asked, what's the context? What is this doing here? We previously were talking about happy is a woe to a land whose king is young, and its officers eat in the morning, right? That was verse 16. And 17 said the opposite, that happy is a land whose king is free, meaning free from his desires. He's not a slave to his instincts. And his officers eat at the right time with strength. Right? And lo bashti. And not with drunkenness. And we talked a bit about that. You see that King Solomon was redressing there that sometimes people who get into power, many times, I would say even most of the times, they don't want it for the right reasons. There's an abuse of the power and the money, and that's why you have a case where you have a king who acts like a youngster, like just going after his desires. And how many times do you see people getting caught in sex scandals that are, government officials? So this is part of the attraction to power and the abuse of it. And they don't address the needs of the country, but a happy country, a country would be happy if they have, how should we read this? Happy should be the country whose king is free from desires and is really doing things properly and he's serving the people properly. But perhaps what King Solomon is doing here is that he wants to bring this, because a lot of times a person can ignore, that's the government, that has nothing to do with me. But perhaps to bring this home, and I didn't mean to say home as a metaphor, I mean to bring this to a person's real sense of reality of how negative that can be, King Solomon is illustrating the point of people who are lazy, who just go after the money and just want to satisfy their needs and don't want to work to address the country. So if this applies to you, so how does he make this a real type of a warning? He uses the example of your own home, because that's something which is real to everybody. And perhaps that's why he's bringing it in. I believe actually Ibn Ezra says that. Meaning this very lesson that he was talking about up to this point, now he wants to relate it to the typical resident. Nobody in power. And you can see from your own experience that if you're going to be lazy, so the roof is going to sag. And if you do that on a macro level, if you have people in government like this, you're going to have a country that will end up being devastated if people in power don't address the needs of the country and they just lounge. And so perhaps that's why he brings in the house, because that's something which is more real to the person reading this. I mean, how many people really brush shoulders with officials? To a certain extent, it is. It's not real to a person. It's not part of his daily or yearly experience. Do you see that?
Good here.
Okay. But you see that is, evidently this is some sort of a need to address this concept of laziness and lounging. Because you see, he talks about that, woe to the country whose king is like a child, like a nar, like a teen. And his officers, they just involve the eating. The first thing they do, they get up in the morning, they satisfy their cravings. So you see, there is that tendency for a person. I mean, basically, that's what vacation is. Vacation is where a person is pent up, he's in control, he's answering to the boss, he's punching the clock every day, after week, and month after month, and there's a time just to have that release. And I'm not putting down vacation. Person, has to have some sort of a release. That's just human nature. But what that does have in common with laziness is that release. Now the question is, does a person live that way as a lifestyle? So that's the person that King Solomon is ridiculing, where he does that for too long. And a sense of accomplishment, isn't there? Typically a person is on vacation, a week is it's a perfect amount of time, a week, a week and a half, 2 weeks, 3 weeks. I mean, I remember myself, when I was younger, I went to Israel, and I went only for a few weeks. Even after that point, my ambition to get back to work was really kicking in, and I wasn't enjoying the release anymore. And I think that's natural. It's a natural thing that a person wants to accomplish, and it's a good thing, and it's necessary. But certain people, they will just get into that mode of the laziness, and that can bite them, and that can really hurt them. And it is very easy. But the person really has to address something, psychologically about themselves. That why are they not really trying to get out there and make a life for themselves? So that's the first. That's something which is a very strong desire. It's there. There is a time, just like King Solomon said in chapter 3 we did, there's a time and place for everything. We have to know when. And the truth is, most of the time, a person's ego and sense of accomplishment will drive him. That most of the time, 95% of the time, he's satisfied. And he likes to build and move further, progress and move up the ladder and be more successful. That's natural, and that's a good thing. There is a time for, all right, taking a break. Maybe that's a concept of a weekend or so on. But the truth is, a person doesn't really need it that often. Because I believe psychologically, if a person could make inroads daily, that'll be a very satisfying thing. And he'll wake up early to address that. He's driven, and he should do something that he likes. He should enjoy his work, like the rabbis say. But again, that's something which has to be put in check. And if that's who's in power, so then it's, woe to that country. But happy to the country, to the person, to the king who is not a slave to his emotions. And he has officers that they eat with strength and not with drunkenness. So that's why he moves on to 18, our verse. And if you let this laziness get a hold of you. It's going to have negative effects on your most basic needs, your house. But what's the next part? But with the lowness or the weakness of the hands, the house will start to drip. What's new in that statement? Now the damage is there.
Yeah, I mean, presumably, okay, the raft is sunk, and I can see it, but I don't want to do anything about it.
Yeah, I'm not damaged. I'm not wet yet.
Right.
Right. So in the second stage, so now that's even, if the person doesn't act, it's even more of a deranged personality. That he's willing to live in discomfort and to be exposed to the elements. Unless what he's saying is the warning, that he's saying with laziness there's going to be a start, a commencement of a breakdown. That'll be what will happen if you're lazy. And if you still don't act and you don't address what physically demands it, so then you're going to have the repercussions. Because just the sagging roof is not a negative in and of itself. It may look a little warped, but there's no real damage going on. So there's two types of effects. So here's on the plain level here, King Solomon's giving you a warning. He's trying to wake up the person. Because eventually you're going to pay the price. But we can also isolate the fact that he's telling you that there is two areas of maintenance that a person has to address. But it would seem that if he takes care of the first area, the second area will never happen. If he is not lazy, the house will never sag. He'll see it, he'll see some damage, he'll repair it, then the roof will never get to the point where it sags. It only gets to the sagging point because he was lazy. That means he knew something had to be addressed and he didn't do it. So his sense of reality was, you know, the comfort for the self was more important than to live properly. That's an important thing to isolate, to realize that people do have that. Every human being has that. When we see people living a certain way and there's certain emotions that they're giving into, they're not the only ones that have that. Every human being has it. It's just that most people who are responsible don't give into that emotion. Then they are more intelligent and their emotions are not getting them. So they see something has to be addressed. You know, the tire's got a little air is coming out of it. They take care of it. They don't want to end up losing a tire on the highway and, you know, God forbid, getting into an accident. So they're on top of things. They understand. They also see the eventuality of what a circumstance could lead to. So that's another thing which King Solomon was telling you, is that the person who is lazy doesn't even look into the future. That's why the rabbis say in ethics that who is a wise man, he knows the outcome. He looks into the future. How are things going to pan out if I take this road or if I take that road? If I do this or I do that? If I speak this way or I speak that way? The person is always calculating his actions. He's planning if he's intelligent. So the verse really exposes a lot. Will we put a security, that there's really a two-step process that will take place. And it fits into the context because he wants to now make the reality of, you know, poor officials, that should be a reality to us. So he brings it home. that we should be conscious of that. So this, you could really say that this verse is coming to give strength to his argument about make sure that you're living in a place where you're actively involved in putting good people into office. Don't think that it's something that's foreign to you. And in order to make sure, he brings an example from a person's home, his most primary area of security. And since the person will see that as being real, he doesn't want to live in a dilapidated house. So he should recognize, well, you could have a dilapidated town or country. So a person has to be responsible about this. He shouldn't be apathetic when it comes to politics. All right, so any questions or comments? That's pretty much what I wanted to take up today. I started looking forward, but there's still more I want to research for the next verse. Good on your end?
Yep.
Jim, did you have something to say? You all right?
Could we also take this as a metaphor for intellectual maintenance? As somebody who sees this in their studies, they begin to forget things, but it doesn't seem important. But they're losing their motivation, and as time goes on, their character begins to crumble as well.
Well, the rabbis do say, they made a phrase, im tazveni yom, yomayim ezveka, which means that if you forsake me one day, I will forsake you 2 days. Who's the me? So it's the Torah. The Torah is speaking, meaning wisdom. Wisdom is telling a person, if you forsake me for a day, meaning if you do not engage in wisdom for a full day, so wisdom that says, I'm going to forsake you for 2 days. What does that mean? It means that if a person removes himself from just day of learning, so it's not just one day he needs to get back into it. There's an exponential damage that goes on. Because what happens is that if you're not involved in intelligence, so then you have to only be involved in one other thing, and that's emotions. There's only two parts to a human being. So if a person let himself go from his involvement to wisdom for a day, so that means that he was investing that day into emotions. So let's say it's Monday, he took off from wisdom. That means Monday he was involved in emotions. Tuesday he can't just jump right back into wisdom again. Tuesday he now has to spend that time removing, extracting himself from the wrong ideas until he could finally regroup, and then by Wednesday he can get back into it. So it's really, if he abandons it on Monday, he can't get back into it really until Wednesday. And that's not an exact measure. It's basic idea the rabbis are trying to express that if you left wisdom, it had to be because you got involved in emotions. It's the only other thing. And if you did get involved in emotions, to withdraw from an emotion takes energy. It takes time because the attraction, it's a magnet. The closer you bring a piece of metal to the magnet, the more strength you need to pull it away. So the more you got involved, you spend a day in the emotions, now it's going to take another day to neutralize, to remove yourself back, and then get back. But if you were studying all day Monday, or if you had involvement to some extent in wisdom on Monday, Tuesday, you're still in it. You're still in that, we say, you're in the parsha, which means that you're in that state of mind. You haven't lost it, because you've continued on a daily basis. So I agree 100%, Jim, yes. I think this applies clearly to that. And maybe even in a greater measure, because if the roof sags, but you could say that the more damage something has, the more work it takes to repair. So maybe it is a direct analogy.
I'd like to take a little issue with the sages on that.
Sure.
Maybe it's just the interpretation of words, but if what they're saying is, well, if you take a day away from study, and since there's only intellect and emotions, then you will have been fully involved in your emotions, and it'll take you that much longer to catch up. That seems to equate study with intellect, and it seems like you can go through a day and operate according to your intellect without necessarily be studying. In other words, just because because I don't have my nose in a book doesn't mean I'm operating in accordance with my emotions.
I'm not sure. I'm not saying that. Let's just see. If a person is not involved in intelligence in terms of study, of wisdom, so you're saying he could still be using his intelligence. But the question would be then, where is he applying that intelligence? So let's say he's working. Let's say it's a day where he's involved in work. So there, he's steeped in providing for himself. He could be a certain amount of supervisory activity he's doing, so that can lend to the ego, or he could just be working on his own if he's an independent contractor, so he still, his focus is on sustaining himself, livelihood, which is important. But what happens is that the intelligence can be active, but what's happening is that the emotions, he's still being engaged in addressing certain emotional needs, so that has an effect on the person.
Well, all right, so let's take a guy that by circumstances is forced to work a double shift at his job.
Right.
Let's say he's dealing in a retail environment with people.
Right.
So all he's thinking about how best to serve this person, how to deal with that angry person, and he's operating with his intellect in dealing with the situations that he's involved in.
Right.
Now, that to me doesn't automatically say, well, because he wasn't involved in learning, he wasn't using his intellect, which is, seems like what the sages are saying, kind of back to, if you don't have your nose in a book, you're in your emotions.
No, they're not saying that you abandoned intellect, that you abandoned wisdom, I mean, the pursuit of wisdom. I mean, Torah means that the person who abandoned the pursuit of wisdom for a day doesn't mean that his intellect isn't being operating. And the truth is also, Rabbi Chaitwin said, I think this strengthens you, your side of it, is that, you know, a person could be, you know, one person could be learning 14 hours a day, but it could be very, very superficial. Another person could gain by learning just 1 hour that day. And that person who had that 1 hour of real, you know, he really uncovered a new idea or his attitude, or even if it was 10 minutes, but if his mind during the day was, he knew he had to work, he had this double shift he had to do, but if his mind still knew, if he's the type of person where he always goes back to wisdom, and that's really where he wants to get to, but he understands that he has to work right now, so I don't know if it applies to that type of person, because his mindset is still engaged in wisdom. He's still engaged in the desire to see more knowledge. So I think we'll have to, you know, make gray areas over here and remove it from the absolute, which is, I understand your critique of how I presented it. Because based on what Rabbi Chait said, so that person who just has 1 hour compared to the guy who was sitting and studying for 14 hours, let's say, so the guy with the 1 hour that really had quality, so that can equally relate to a half an hour or even 15 minutes. If that's the attitude of the person's soul, I believe that's how Rabbi Chait put it, that even if he had to work the whole day, you know, and he had to do it because of his responsibilities to his family. But if his mind is one that naturally gravitates and does go back to wisdom, that's where it's always in the back of his mind. He wants to return to wisdom. So you can't say that's a person who left wisdom for a day. But in the same token, right? In the same token, though, I would say that if a person is, again, I still will stick to what I said earlier, that even if a person is not involved in pursuing wisdom, but now he still can be using his wisdom during the day, it's just that he could be serving emotional needs. And that could be something which hurts the person. So I guess it'll have to be weighed on a case-by-case basis. Because you can see people that use intelligence just for their own, like Haman. He used intelligence to get to, you know, but his, what was the underlying drive was his ego. So the intelligence did nothing for him. He had great intelligence, but it didn't do anything for him. So you could use intelligence, but it doesn't mean that that's a guarantee that it's the person is perfect in any way.
basically worked all day and worked on, you know, as a physician for the king and then on behalf of the people, and that somebody wanted to come talk to him about some ideas, and he said, don't bother to come because I don't have any time for learning. I'm just able to get a little bit in on Shabbos.
Yeah, I would say about a person like that, that that's not his own decision. He really is the person we just talked about. That his mind always, in the back of his mind, he is only doing it under duress, that he has to. And he was enslaved, you know, to the Sultan. He had to do all these things. He had to be his doctor. And he, I remember what you were talking about. He was writing prescriptions as he hit the bed. He was so exhausted. He didn't have no real time. But a person like that, his energy, his attitude is, never leaves learning. So I would not say that that applies to a person like that. And today, too. You don't have to be a Maimonides. If a person has an attitude where he values wisdom and he really longs for it, and but he understands he has to go through the motions and he has to do the work and he has to do a good job of work, so I don't say it applies to that person. This critique does not apply to that person because his attitude has not abandoned it. It's the person who selects to leave learning. That's what it's talking about. I think that's a better way of saying it. The person, it's an elective that he wants to do other things. I mean, he has the ability to learn, but he removes himself from it. He chooses not to. So that means there's something about wisdom also that maybe he's repelling. I know I have that myself. There can be, a week or two ago, whatever. Remember, I saw myself like a day or two. I was not able to get into the studies. So many things I had to address. But, you know, you still have it on your mind. And when you see somebody who you learn with and you always discuss an idea, so you're right back into it. So I would say from my own experience, it doesn't even apply. But there still could be some effect that there is a loss of the mind not being involved in the engagement of how wisdom works. Meaning when you're applying your wisdom to just mere manipulation of things and strategies and business and addressing needs, meaning the physical. If the mind is being used there, that's a different type. You know, just say, you know, something more now that I'm thinking about it, there is a different type of state of mind. It's more in terms of practical. Your mind is being engaged in the practical. So if that's true, and you're doing that for a day or two, whatever, for an elongated period of time, there is some detachment, or there is some type of a time it'll take to get to re-engage, you know, in terms of the thought process and wisdom. I think that might be true. I don't think and the truth is also, to even go further, maybe this statement of the rabbis, where they said, they personified the Torah. And the Torah said, if you leave me one day, I'll leave you for two. So maybe this is the reality they're telling you. Maybe it's not necessarily a critique. Maybe they understood this too, that sometimes people have to go and they're working and it requires a journey. A person can't be held blameful for that. So maybe I have to correct, because I think I presented it as a critique, and really maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a statement, like the rabbis talk about all facets of human experience, and this is just another facet, and they're just giving us insight. We should be aware of this. Could be. I'll see if I can look. I can track down the actual quote and find out. Let me write this down. Let's see if I can do this. And once I find it, I'll send an email out to the list. Okay. Write that down. All right, so it's good. I'm glad you brought that up, Doug. To help develop it, to help actually show it in a completely different light, actually. All right, any other questions or comments? Okay, so you know, Doug, I'll look that up, and I'll send an email out to the list if I find the source and I see some more commentary on that. And I'll share it with everybody. Thanks for bringing that up.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I wish everybody a good week, and we'll pick up next Sunday, same time, and we'll do, we'll move on to the next verse, which is 10:19.
Okay, thanks, Rabbi.
Okay.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thanks, Rabbi. Have a good week.
You too, everybody. Have a good week.